And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. I'm going to tell you right at the beginning that today's show will deal with suspense, how it works, when it doesn't work, and how you create it, even in a movie where, let's face it, you know the Titanic is going to sink. We'll move from drama to music and talk about cover versions, both the great ones and the ones that only exist in our dreams. And as always, we'll talk about what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Our friend Trey Graham has the week off this week, but fortunately we are joined by our friend Barry Hardiman. Barry Hardiman, what do you do at NPR?
I'm an editor at Weekend Edition, Saturday and Sunday.
Well, we're happy to see you as always, and, you know, because the suspense has been killing me.
There you go.
You know?
Exactly. Well, that's quite a segue.
Yeah, you know, I'm the expert. So the first thing we're going to talk about this week is suspense. Now, one of the reasons we're talking about this is that this weekend was the opening of the Ben Affleck-directed film Argo. And I had seen Argo in Toronto at the film festival, but this was the first time. I know Steven saw it this weekend.
I did.
And I saw it again this weekend because that is how much I like it.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Steven, why don't you talk a little bit about Argo and explain sort of a little bit what it's about and then tell the nice people what you thought of it.
Okay, first of all, before I start talking about Argo, I want to talk about how the Les Miserables trailer is ruining the movies
and
the movie-going experience.
The last time I was here, I was talking about how it made my life better.
No.
Oh, no. Now we have to gladiate.
Now, between now and Christmas Day, every time you go to the movies, at least at the Regal Majestic Theater in downtown Silver Spring, they play the 7-minute excruciating trailer for Les Miserables.
Is it really 7 minutes? There's a new one?
It's 7 minutes.
It's a little featurette about the live singing.
I dreamed a dream.
It was fine the first time. The third time, seeing it before Looper, seeing it before Hotel Transylvania.
I know, really.
So Barry, it's always boring when people tell you about their dreams. Always. No,
but if it's in Days Gone By, it just kind of
All right, so now that you've gotten that off your chest.
Thank you. Back me up, people. Horrible. 25 minutes of trailers.
I understand.
Okay. Argo is awesome. Argo is unbelievably, massively entertaining and great.
And what is it about?
Oh, what's it about? Oh, the things it's about. See, this is where we find out that I didn't actually see it. No. Basically, Argo is the basically true telling.
Kind of true, yeah.
You can tell that things happen a little bit more suspensefully than they probably
Yes, I think so.
There's probably more paperwork.
I think so.
in the actual life.
And less Ben Affleck.
So it's about the set at the time of the hostage crisis in Iran.
Correct. And basically, you had about 50 hostages who were taken in the U.S. embassy in Iran, in Tehran. And then during the actual taking of the embassy, which is staged massively effectively.
Yeah.
Six of the people who were in the building.
Who worked in the building.
Basically flee out into the streets. And because the havoc has all sort of moved into the building, they're able to sort of slip out unseen. But then...
Then what?
Then what? Where do you go? And so basically they wind up in the Canadian ambassador's house, holed up as... You know, there's basically this crisis that people don't even know about.
Right.
It's unreported on that these people are not actually hostages. They're caught between, I mean, they're not free at all. They're almost worse than hostages.
Right. And so the movie is essentially about the operation that went in and got them out. And the cover that they used was that they were part of a film crew filming a cheap science fiction movie. That's where the name Argo comes from. And this is a thing that really happened. This part is really how they went and got these people out. And so, of course, one of the great things about the movie, I think, is they talk about how nobody would believe that Canadians were there for most reasons. Like, no sane person would be there as a teacher or an expert or whatever, but people believe that Hollywood people are so crass that that they would film anywhere if they thought it was going to be cheap and a good place to film. So he basically says, well, they'll believe anything about Hollywood people. So it's essentially the story of how they got them out. So in terms of suspense, the thing that I think is so interesting about Argo is how suspenseful and exciting it is, despite the fact that basically you know what happens.
Yep.
Like, essentially, it's historically reported. People know they got the people out. That's a known story.
Right.
So how do you create such an incredibly suspenseful film, which is like in the final act, it's just maddening. There's all this stuff and you're so tense and it's like, what's going to happen? Are they going to get the tickets in time? Are they going to get caught? Are they going to get stopped by this guard? How about this guard? How about that guard? And even though you know what happens,
right,
it's incredibly tense. And I walk out of the theater and the first thing my friend says to me before I can say anything is, it's amazing how worked up I got about that movie despite the fact that I knew what was going to happen.
Yeah. But I mean, at the same time, you have to consider in a lot of cases with a lot of massively suspenseful movies, you also kind of know that the good guys are going to live.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an element of suspense is that, as Hitchcock put it in in this really great book that's called Hitchcock by Francois Truffaut, it's just a series of interviews, a transcript of interviews they did over 5 days. It's like 50 hours of conversation. And he talks about what suspense is the audience thinking it knows more or actually knowing more than the characters. The example he uses, if there are a couple at a cafe talking and a bomb goes off and they get killed, that's 15 seconds of surprise. If you show the bomb getting planted and that it's going to go off at 1 o'clock and have a big old clock behind them as they're talking, that's suspense. That's 15 minutes of you just paying rapt attention to what they're saying and wanting to scream at the screen. And suspense, in a way, is very meta. It's about the movie-going experience of watching something and wanting to be able to kind of jump into the screen and say something, but you can't. You're watching something play out that you are divorced from.
Yeah. And in this case, you know, part of what you know that they don't is how it's going to end. And you sort of know, you know. And yet, I think it also demonstrates that suspense is not outcome-based. It is stakes-based and scene and built within a scene as opposed to over the course of an entire movie, because even though you know essentially what the outcome is, in each individual scene and sequence, the suspense is built for that individual scene, how that individual problem is going to be solved. Even if you know that ultimately the problems will get solved, in every individual one, you don't know exactly how that's going to happen. Barry, you're a Hitchcock person.
I am a Hitchcock person. I have always called him my favorite misogynist. I thought when you said bomb, I thought you were going to say blonde goes off. But the films that I like the best do tend to be the more sort of the psychosexual, desire-based suspense films. Although I do love Charade. I love all of those things as well. But I love, like, Marnie, in which he does this weird thing, which is literally just about this poor woman's identity, basically, throughout the whole movie, and some other sort of weird Sean Connery rapey stuff. But the desire itself can be a form of suspense. Whose desires will be strongest? You know, and Vertigo, which I think is a sort of weird twin of Marnie, and those are my favorites of all time. I want to go home and watch them right now. I think has that same sort of thing where you don't know whose desires are going to win out, and the suspense is actually more about that than even the is so and so going to make off with the briefcase or not kind of suspense.
Now, Barry, would you agree that Hitchcock is about repression?
Yes. Oh, goodness.
He's about there's a certain internal rigor to a lot of his, to especially like the ones that are really pseudo psychology, like Marnie and Vertigo Spellbound.
Oh, Spellbound.
Which has a very sort of pop psychology version of what Freudian analysis.
Including the Dolly,
But probably really popularized a lot of Freudian concepts to the American populace, who probably thought they were, you know, for learned people or something like that.
Right.
Or book smart people. But, I mean, it's a really basic understanding of what psychology is like. Psychology and psychiatry is this key that unlocks people.
Right.
Very simplistic.
Right.
But once you get into the 70s and the lapels get wider and the hair gets longer, he becomes less relevant.
He becomes less interesting.
He's much less interesting. Yeah. He doesn't have anything to say anymore when the sexual revolution happens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I would absolutely agree. And when is Psycho?
60.
Oh, 60. Really?
Yeah.
I don't even like Psycho that much. But because to me, that is, it is the less interesting Freudian analysis. Like, oh my God, he means his mother?
Well,
like,
absolutely. Okay, and I mean, the way that they lay that on at the end is obviously probably his most mocked sequence.
Right. But I know what you mean. I mean, I think as soon as you get into those later movies, it does become a little less like, okay, well, you've already given us this primer and now there is nothing. Now that there isn't as much you can hide, it's not as interesting.
Well,
no,
and I think
that's a very good analysis.
I think the more, as with a lot of things, the more he makes things explicit, the less interesting they become. So the dynamics in a movie like Dial M for Murder, which I love, the dynamics of that movie are not meant to be quite as fraught as some of the other ones. That's more of a straight up What do you do when you want to get rid of your wife? And then it just becomes really
right.
a puzzle of sort of, you know, if you see that movie, there's all this stuff about which key is in which pocket at which time and mm-hmm. the fact that all keys looked essentially alike is mm-hmm. very important. And it just becomes this kind of, can you follow which thing is in which place, which is very different from these kind of, and so
right.
the suspense in that one is more simple. The suspense in that one is more like, who's going to find what thing at what time?
Yeah.
And that's also the feeling of like a movie like Rear Window.
Yes.
Where you have this very suspenseful sequence. The one I always think of is when he's watching Grace Kelly over in the guy's apartment mm-hmm. and he can see her and he can see that the guy is coming into the apartment
right.
and she's about to get
right.
caught, and it's just...
And everyone is the audience.
And
he's the audience.
Right.
You're the audience.
Right.
It's
exactly.
like the closest you can do to me. Yeah.
But this is also the difference. I mean, you were talking about repression versus mm-hmm. the sexual revolution and sort of how that affects his movies. I mean, also look at the difference between suspense and horror.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
And,
I would want to talk
and
about that.
To
yeah.
me... You know, and we've talked about horror on this show before. None of us are huge horror buffs. All of us, I think, are big suspense buffs. And I just think that anticipation and that kind of ratcheting up of audience engagement is just so much more compelling than just watching people get hacked to pieces on the screen.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
There may be more of a mystery as to who's going to wind up surviving all the people getting hacked to
mm-hmm.
pieces.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But the kind of white-knuckle experience mm-hmm. of waiting to see how on earth they're going to get out of this. That's so much better. And I think the thing with Argo, it really is like a lot of mysteries. It's like watching Columbo. You know, you're watching Columbo, you know who the murderer is. You know the murderer is mm-hmm. going to get caught. You want to see how. It's sort of how are they going to solve the puzzle? In Argo, you're just watching how do they solve the puzzle.
Right.
Yeah.
Mystery is kind of an intellectual exercise, and suspense is a very sort of
visceral
yeah. bodily exercise.
Yeah.
And Hitchcock actually agreed with your point, Stephen. He said that there is no terror in the explosion, only in the anticipation of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's kind of what you're talking about there.
Right.
Real quick, in college I took a Hitchcock course, but I was a scientist, right? I was coming from quantitative analysis, needed to get the old GPA up because it was kicking my butt. So I didn't know the lingo that you humanities types use. So the professor starts off by talking about Hitchcock's male gaze. And I was like, so Farley Granger and Anthony Perkins. Who else? So literally.
Oh, and North by Northwest.
Martin Landau.
Yeah.
Landau's
yeah.
character, yeah.
Yeah.
And James Mason. Oh. Literally half the class. I'm sitting there going, well, these guys sound like jerks. They're
yeah.
always objectifying women and
oh,
reducing them to
I love
to
you.
Body parts. And then I was like, it's just like the fashion industry. I went off on a whole thing. And then I had to kind of erase three.
Paris. Yeah, it's interesting with Hitchcock, because I was just watching Strangers on a Train this
mm-hmm.
weekend, because I was,
oh.
which if people who talk to me on Twitter know this, I was following it. It was really making me think Hitchcock movies really would be, a lot of them would really be hosed in an era of no-fault divorce.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yes.
Because so
yeah.
many of them rely so heavily on people trying to get out of marriages
right.
and get rid of wives
right.
and other things like that. Yeah. Whereas in the age we're in now, it's like, you don't need these complex plans.
No.
It's no-fault divorce. You
Absolutely.
Don't have so quite so much, you know, incentive.
You want to be the ice queen in a Hitchcock film. You don't want to be the brunette. Brunettes
no.
always
no.
come to a bad end.
No, that's true.
You either get named Midge, which
yeah.
is not going to be,
yeah,
it's not
no.
going to work out well for you.
No.
No.
Or
way.
You're going to get pecked to death by birds like poor Suzanne Plachette. Suzanne Plachette got a raw deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's true.
Raw is
well,
right.
And honestly, the Blondes did not do that well either. And there's obviously been lots of talk about that. And in fact, HBO is just about to air their version of the story of Hitchcock and Tippi Hedren during the filming of The Birds. But I think what comes out in all of those movies is, like, there is always between, like you say about repression, there is always between all these people all this stuff that either they can't express or they're not willing to talk about. And I don't know. The other thing I said about Strangers on a Train is that one of the lessons is, like, never get involved in a scheme with someone who's a way worse person than you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
they're always, yeah.
if anytime anyone who's, like, if you're not a genuinely bad person... If a genuinely bad person starts trying to plot with you, tell them no.
Get off the train.
It will not go well, because you will never come out ahead in a scheme with a person who's much worse than you.
May I bring up another medium?
Sure.
Since Hitchcock made a movie of my favorite book of suspense, Rebecca.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think it's a much different experience to see Chekhov's gun, I mean, on
mm-hmm.
to watch the bomb be planted and whatever. But I do think what's interesting about... So Rebecca is based on a book by Daphne du Maurier, which is one of the great pieces of romance suspense fiction. It is It should be read by every teenage girl at camp. It's just a great book. Mm-hmm. And boys at camp as well.
I'll read it for a teenage girl.
But I will say the reading of suspense is such a different experience because you are not actually watching the puzzle pieces be put together in such a way that they can then be taken apart. And one of the things that I think is so great about that book is that there are all of these ways that the language is planting clues that you are not even aware of, you know, that you really never, ever know the narrator's name. And these are all things that Hitchcock then, you know, picked up in his, when he put it on the screen. And I think, too, that the slowness of a piece of fiction unfolding, I mean, it isn't necessarily white-knuckled, but the book is building a case for you of suspense.
Right.
It's building, and that I love movies, I love Hitchcock movies, but I love the experience of reading a book of suspense and that feeling of like, oh my God, like Gone Girl, I have to shut the book.
Yeah.
Now I have to open it. Oh, I have to shut it again. is the best feeling in the world, and I may even prefer it to the white-knuckled grip of the movie seat.
Yeah, and I was just going to say because Barry, you and I have both talked about Gone Girl a bunch of times, and I think when I sat and tried to think about what is it about that book, one of the things that came to mind is that the first half is a mystery novel and the second half is a suspense novel.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Because first half desire, second
and it's
half
exactly
puzzle.
For the reason that we already talked about, where your amount of information is massively different.
Mm-hmm.
You go from the first half of the book where you can't figure out what's going on and you're trying to figure out what's going on to the second half of the book where you basically know what's going on and you're just waiting for everything to shake out. So it's half a mystery novel, and that's why it feels like two books. When I was saying to people after I read it, well, there's the first book and then there's really the second book. And it's because one's a mystery and one's suspense.
Right.
So it's a great way to feel that feeling of like you shift from you have no information to having information. And they're both, you know, they both can be very satisfying. But for me, the suspense is more satisfying.
And I think the moment in any book, this is a very different experience than a movie, that you get the information, even if it's great expectations, oh my God, that's where the money came from.
Right.
That moment is, for me, and I sound like a total jerk, but is almost more pleasurable than the feeling of watching the bomb be planted.
Really good writers of thrillers and suspense novels know that there's a magic that happens as you come to the end of a chapter. You slow down. You see that giant white space. And all of a sudden, everything you've been skimming. Yep. You've been kind of jumping from from piece of dialogue to piece of dialogue because they're talking about what color the table is again.
Right.
So you slow down, and the last few paragraphs and the last few sentences attain more power to do whatever they're going to do.
Yeah.
And then it ends. And so there's built in.
It's like the retard in a piece of music.
Exactly. Yeah. It's in the infrastructure of the book. And really good writers really know how to work that.
This is what I love about Hunger Games.
Because
every single chapter ends with a reversal of fortune.
And that
so
was
you
one thing,
always hooked.
And when you were pitching me on the Hunger Games, that was one of the things you said, was that you kind of get to the end of the chapter. And it's kind of like if you're watching a TV show and it's 8:58 and you're like, they can't possibly, you know.
Yeah.
And so...
I mean, I think sort of what we're coming around, and to come sort of back around to Argo, I think the reason why that movie works is that it's both this idea that suspense is different from mystery, but also, like I was saying earlier, suspense is built around small chunks of stories. So without giving too much away, by the time you get to the end of Argo, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on at the same time.
Yeah.
Over here, you have this threat to them getting away. Over here, you have this threat to them getting away. Will they get the plane tickets in time? Will they get, you know, as I was saying earlier, pass this guard?
When will they figure out?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. What's the moment that they, you know, and I think that's a lot of what is in reality not what happened. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think those are the pieces that in reality, you know.
Well, there's the art then.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But
it is
built scene by scene. It is not structural to the entire book, the building of suspense, its structure, or movie. It is structural to
those moments.
Well, one thing that movie does really, really well in terms of suspense, so much suspense is simply built around peril. And just sort of the building and building and building of a feeling of the characters being imperiled. If you've ever seen Wait Until Dark, which I mentioned really, really briefly in passing a couple weeks ago, you know, it's another one where the audience knows more than the character does because the character who is in peril is blind.
Right.
And so you know more than she does, and you're sitting there like, as you know, the peril approacheth. And I think that Argo is able to achieve a lot of that same thing where it creates this kind of three-dimensional kind of moving in on you everything is peril. And there are these amazing scenes where they're kind of moving through the town. And the town is kind of this angry, throbbing mass that's kind of enveloping them at all times. And mm-hmm. it is an incredibly claustrophobic and terrifying experience to watch, even though you know what happens.
Yeah. This is sort of why I'm intolerant of the idea that the biggest threat to your enjoyment of a story is spoilers.
Right.
Is that my feeling is always it isn't spoilers that ruin a story like that. It's lack of stakes. Uh-huh. So the other thing about Argo that I think is important is that for all that you know it happens, they build up enough. You're very sympathetic to the people who are trying to get rescued. You learn enough about who they are. Mm-hmm. You learn enough about why they're there. You learn enough about how different people feel about, you know, a guy who brought his wife with him and how he feels about that, that she's now in this situation. You learn about them and you care about their situation. You care about the Canadian ambassador. And so you sort of feel like the stakes are there. And so that, to me, is what's most important.
Well, and all most people know is they live.
Mm-hmm.
How many movies do you know they live?
Right.
You know, most people are not scholars in terms of this story.
Well, and it's not just the historical fact that makes you know that they're going to live. It's also the tone of the movie. Because as I've said about this movie a couple of other times, there is a sort of capery, Ocean's 11-y kind of feeling to parts of the story.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And you wouldn't be getting that tone and these great scenes with John Goodman and Alan Arkin if they were all going to die at the end. So it's even if you didn't know the story, it's built into the fabric of the movie that it's probably not going to wind up with everyone dies.
I want to see this right now and it's not so just good. For the Les Miserables trailer.
As I told you, I saw it as soon as it came out. I had seen it in Toronto and I saw it.
That's
I
amazing.
Started talking about wanting to see it again. So anyway, I think we all recommend Argo and Hitchcock.
Right.
All right. Well, we really do absolutely need to move on because we are getting into something that is very close, I know, to Stephen's heart, which is, Stephen, why don't you tell us a little bit about this, how we got on this topic and, you know.
This topic was suggested on our Facebook page. Mm-hmm. Somebody was sort of asking, what are your dream cover songs?
Mm-hmm.
If you could pick a song and an artist to perform it, what would it be?
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, I have the absolute checkmate best answer to this ever, which we'll get to.
You really do.
I am so right about
this. You really do.
But we figured it was an opportunity to kind of go into a larger discussion of cover songs and sort of what works about a great cover song and that we would each sort of recommend one of our favorites.
Absolutely. And Stephen, I know that you at one point in your life had a whole thing about this, about dream covers and stuff like that.
Yeah, I had this dream. I had this dream for an album, and somebody kind of did something like this long after I had this idea that I never got off the ground. It was going to be called the Reclamation Project, and it was going to be my favorite bands reclaiming songs that people think are bad and making them good.
Mm-hmm.
And the perfect example.
This drives him crazy. If it doesn't happen before he shuffles off this mortal coil, his life will have been a waste.
It's actually the only thing that keeps me going. Otherwise, I'm just dribbling the ball at half court, just waiting for the clock to run out. But once this idea happens.
Just tell him.
Okay. There's a song by Enrique Iglesias called Escape. You know the song, right?
I know
you
the
can
song.
Run, you can yeah, hide, let, let, but you can't yeah. escape.
Okay, so here's a few seconds of Escape by Enrique Iglesias. Okay. Now, that's a really catchy song. That's not a bad song.
No.
Now, here are a few seconds of The New Pornographers. How have The New Pornographers not covered this song? Where you have Nico Case kind of bellowing the hook?
You're right.
I heartily endorse this event or product.
As soon as you explained that to me, I could hear it in my head, and I thought, you're absolutely 1,000% correct. That must happen.
I'm right about so few things that when I hit on one, that's perfect.
It's true. I mean, I sit there
that's
and I thought,
really
well,
good,
it is a Steven idea, so...
I want armies. I want the pop culture happy hour army amassing outside A.C. Newman's house,
yeah.
demanding that this song happen.
It should.
But that idea, in that idea, you look at what makes a good cover song.
Right. Mm-hmm. So explain your reasoning there. Explain your criteria.
First of all, I think it's having played a little bit of each song, you can sense that there are similar qualities to both. But I think that what I really love in a cover song is when it can bring out something in the song that you haven't thought about.
Mm-hmm.
If you can bring out a quality in the song that wasn't there except in subtext.
Mm-hmm.
An example that I wanted to bring is an album by a singer named Mark Kozlik, who has been the singer in Red House Painters and Sun Kill Moon, and is maybe the mopiest mope in all of mopedom.
And you would know.
And I would know. So this album's called What's Next to the Moon, and it is all covers of Bon Scott-era AC/DC. And it sounds like a dopey gimmick, sort of like when there were all these punk pop covers of, you know, Feelings, whoa, you know, and you just got so sick of that after a while.
I want more of you doing that. I'm not sick of it at all now.
but you know, the flip side of that phenomenon is the sort of let's take a rock and roll song and turn it into a dirge. But Kozlik does it really, really well. So let's hear a few seconds of Bad Boy Boogie by by AC/DC from the 1977 album Let There Be Rock. Okay, and now let's hear a few seconds of sad-ass Mark Kozlik doing the same song.
Being bad ain't so bad. I've known more pretty women than most men have.
What I love about the Kozlik record, he also did an album of Modest Mouse covers, kind of in the same style. What I love about it is you realize that these AC/DC songs are incredibly sad.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen to a line like, being bad ain't so bad, I've known more pretty women than most men have. And you hear that as sung, the plaintive guitar. Man,
right.
It's like, my life, it's over.
Oh.
Yeah. So most adolescent boasts are
right.
Just sad.
Yeah. Right. And when you have an adolescent boast.
You found the sad heart of the.
And if anybody can, it's like I said, it's Mark Kozlik.
You would, and you. Glenn Weldon, do you have any suggestion for us?
Oh, I got plenty. I mean, I kind of like the phenomenon that you dismissed at the beginning there, Stephen, where you take a treacly, sappy song and you give it a pulse. The Violent Femmes do a great cover of Do You Really Want to Hurt Me? Culture Club. Too Much Joy does a great version of Seasons in the Sun, which really makes it...
I'm so glad you like Too Much Joy.
I love Too Much Joy. Love Too Much Joy. Can't talk about this without talking about They Might Be Giants' cover of Istanbul, not Constantinople, which makes a swing song better by adding what? Klezmer. Of course. Why have we not done this before?
Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople. Now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
On the show, The Comeback, the character Valerie Cherish, played by Lisa Kudrow, sings a version of I Will Survive, which adds to it this note of plaintive desperation. It's on YouTube. It's the best 3 minutes you're going to spend on YouTube this year. It's fantastic. But we can't talk about this without talking about a little album from 1968 called The Transformed Man by one Bill Shatner. Now, this is the album where all of the stuff that we've come to know him, you know, all the Priceline ads, this is all where it mm-hmm. comes from. But this was before that happened. In the late 80s and early 90s, Golden Throats
yep.
came out, and they put together a lot of, you know, celebrities who can't sing doing songs they shouldn't sing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of this effect. And so that's when The Transformed Man kind of found its place. But the original album is only 6 tracks long, and he's taking poetry and matching it with pop lyrics and, you know, delivering it in a very stentorian, Shatner-y style. So what you don't realize is that all the stuff you've heard, like his version of Mr. Tambourine Man, which is genius, and It Was a Very Good Year, which is terrible, and Lucy in the Sky with Diamond, which is bananas. That's the back half of each of these tracks. He starts by doing Cyrano, which segues into Mr. Tambourine Man. He starts by doing a Hamlet, a monologue from Hamlet, which transitions into It Was a Very Good Year when I was 21. It was a very good year. I mean, it's perfect. And then he does, my favorite thing is that to lead into Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which is bananas, he starts with Spleen by Baudelaire. It's crazy.
Cellophane flowers of yellow and green towering over your head. Look for the girl with a sun in her eyes. And she's gone!
She's gone! She's gone!
This album, Transform Man, is available on iTunes, so you can listen to it. In
unlike the complete collected works of AC/DC.
Right, or Golden Throats is not available, which also sucks. But by the way, if you want to clear a room on one
and
of the...
And I do.
Yes. When you're at a party, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you want people to go home, there is nothing that will clear a room like putting on an 85-year-old Mae West's piercing, unsteady, falsetto yelling.
All right, Barry Hardiman, talk to me about covers.
I just want to say, you know, these gentlemen, hats off. But I do want to point out one thing about AC/DC. One of my favorite cover ideas is the Pickin' On series, and which is the bluegrassing of the bluegrassing. I don't know if that's a verb of
string band covers
of like Modest Mouse, and there's a wonderful AC/DC, and I love this. Particularly the AC/DC thing, and you have now put your finger on exactly the reason that I love it, is that it has pulled out the sad desires of, you know, those long-haired gentlemen.
So you're saying I shouldn't have laughed when I got a CD called The Vitamin String Quartet Plays 30 Seconds to Mars?
No, you shouldn't.
Maybe the least essential album of all time?
No, but you should look into your soul. So this is the thing I love is the, you know, and in general, if I can hear a country singer sing, you know, a Britney Spears song, this is where, you know, I find, you know, joy and happiness in covers. But one other thing I want to point out is that the covers business in general has benefited so much from reality shows.
Yeah.
I mean, who knew that Paris Ooh La La was such a good song until The Voice, The X Factor?
Yeah. That's a fair point.
So I really, one of the reasons that I tune into The Voice in particular is to hear songs that I may have dismissed, sometimes sung badly, sometimes sung very well, sometimes very interestingly. To hear these songs sung by someone else. And this is the thing I love about the American Idol sort of thing, is that you are really, really hearing a lot of songs, a lot of covers.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, they've been very good to one of my favorite songs of all time, which is Bonnie Raitt's I Can't Make You Love Me.
Oh, my God, yes.
Which is such an incredible song. And when you hear it kind of cycled through every single season of American Idol, you realize it has helped make that song more of a standard.
Yeah. No, I think it's true. It is creating new standards. You heard it here.
Well.
From Stephen, and I agreed.
Glee and Pitch Perfect are both built on the notion of covers. And this whole experience, because I don't listen to your top 40 radio with the rock and roll and the raccoon coats and
did you see Pitch Perfect?
I did see Pitch Perfect. And again, it's the same thing that happens with Glee, which is here's somebody singing a song I never heard of, mashed up with this other song I'd never heard of. So it's the first time I've ever heard it. So it just doesn't reach me, which is just my short way of saying I'm old and frightened.
This is the thing I love, is I'm discovering pop music that I just, you know, that I wasn't Christmas shopping that year, so I never knew it, you know, or whatever. And that I love about these shows.
Yeah. The thing I would stick up for briefly is the anti-cover, the uncover, which is the original version of something where people only know the cover.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Dolly Parton.
Several things that Dolly Parton has done. The Carole King Natural Woman.
Absolutely.
Which, for me, I get the song more from Carole King than I do from Aretha Franklin.
And the Carole King. Carole King did a lot. The James Taylor, You've Got a Friend.
Yep,
she
is a Carole King song. Mm-hmm. And the other one I always mention to people is when Norah Jones had her big Don't Know Why I Didn't Come mm-hmm. song. That's a Jesse Harris and the Ferdinandos song, and he performed with her in on that record. But originally his band did that song, and I like their version of that song better than her incredibly famous version of that song.
I waited till I saw the sun. I don't know why I didn't come. Left you by the house of fun. I don't know why I didn't come.
It's a little less schmoopy. It's a little bit more of a guitar, of a kind of an acoustic guitar-y ballad, and a little bit less built in a way. So
a little less busty.
So very often what I get into is kind of songs where it's not necessarily that the song is a cover. It's that you only know a cover.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And there's a difference between that, obviously, something that just was written for you by someone else, but something where there actually exists a version by the person who wrote the song. And then it becomes, you know, it becomes only known for somebody else's version.
So you have a druthers? Do you have a cover you want, you're waiting for?
You know, I thought about this, and honestly, my brain doesn't work like Stephen's. I can't create in my head something that doesn't exist in terms of music. So I'm going to give my slot to Stephen, who's going to, I guess, give us another one.
All right. Do you know the song The Power of Love, You Are My Lady?
Yes.
Well,
oh, my God.
It's, well, it's
I'm you're when, my lady.
Right.
Sorry.
When,
you
when,
can cut that, too.
And it's, no, no. Oh, no.
No way,
oh,
man.
Oh, no.
It's popularized, like mostly popularized by Celine Dion.
But several people, but her.
But I first,
Air Supply.
I first knew it as
Air,
I first knew it as an Air Supply song. Did they write it?
I don't. No, okay. I don't know.
Okay, that sounds like they could have.
I don't know.
It really does.
That sounds right.
Well, I knew it as an Air Supply song because I was pretty badass in 1985.
So
if you take that song and you remove all the sort of moisture from it.
Nothing is left.
Just take the lyric and have Sam Beam from Iron and Wine perform it. It becomes an incredibly brittle song of desperation and want.
Perfect.
Okay,
wow.
One more.
Yeah.
As you can tell, the Reclamation Project was pretty far along when it didn't happen.
He gave Power of Love a Sudafed.
I did reach out to our esteemed music director, Mike Katziff.
Outstanding.
Who we can throw up some links on the blog. Mm-hmm. Mike has written several pieces for the NPR music site. Mike is sort of really specializes in caring about covers and is always, like, every year he's sort of absorbing all his favorite covers and sort of putting together lists at the end of the year. And I said, Mike, give me a favorite from the last 5 years. And he has this version of the song Borderline by Madonna as performed by the Flaming Lips. Let's hear a little bit of it. It's fantastic, and it's sort of, you know, as he was saying, you know, part of what he likes about it is it sort of gives him a new way of looking at music that just kind of blew past him in another context.
So, Glenn, do you have a dream cover?
Yeah. Of course, we've talked on the show before about Jesus Christ Superfrog, my version of the musical Jesus Christ Superstar. That's an all Muppet version. It just improves it. You just make it better. That's well, the thing.
And it gets rid of the anti-Semitism. It's
it kind of does.
If it's a Muppet,
that's A.
Two birds, one furry stone. The thing is, this is not really a cover. It's more a remaster. I love the music of Ray Charles. Yes, I'm going to say that's something that controversial. I love Ray Charles. All mammals love Ray Charles. That's another thing. I'm not fond of easy listening Ray Charles because I grew up listening to it. It was my parents listened to Georgia On My Mind over and over again, America. Here's the thing. You have this great bluesy voice that does all kinds of things with interesting phrasing in these songs. Let's take Georgia On My Mind. There's a rawness and something that's very loose, if you will, about it, backed up by the whitest chorus of voices so buttoned up you can hear the V-necks through the speaker. It's like you take this blues man and you drop him in the middle of the Lawrence Welk show, and it sucks. It sucks.
So
and
you
just,
want reproduced.
I want Ray Charles without all this mayonnaise that they kind of dump on him whenever they put these backing people who were just, it's all, so just take out those people. You don't need people to say George on my mind after.
So you need the Ray Charles cover of George on my mind.
That's exactly what I want. Let the strings do what those awful buttoned up voices are trying to do. That's what
so
I want.
So you want Rick Rubin to take just the vocal track and have a dirge-like guitar, just one acoustic guitar behind him to make Johnny Cash American Recordings Ray Charles.
There we go. That's exactly what I want.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Outstanding. All right. Well, so I think that what we should probably say is that you should feel free to come to our Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/PCHH, and tell us about your favorite covers, your favorite dream covers. We are taking your advice, and we're happy to pass it on and throw it into the internet where hopefully your favorite artist will see it. And, you know, it could happen. It could happen. I think Stephen's very hopeful about this new pornographers thing. I don't think there's any question. Stephen's hopeful. Speaking of hopeful.
You dreamed a dream.
Yeah. Exactly. Speaking of hopeful, that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
This is the last time I'm going to talk about the book.
Until
it comes out, then all bets are off. Well, it comes out April 9th, 2013. Available now for pre-order on Amazon and other fine booksellers. But right now I'm going over the final copy edits before I turn it in. And the copy editor at Wiley is asking perfectly reasonable questions like, why does the spelling of Mr. and Mrs. Pitlick change? Well, it just does. Was this word capitalized in the original comic? Well, it's a comic, and they use all capital letters, so it's really kind of hard to say. And, you know, why do you say superhero without a hyphen, and then when you talk about Legion of Superheroes, there is a hyphen? So I kind of was, like, getting a little tired of this, because it's just...
It's like having a conversation with my mother.
It's like, shut up, that's why. I mean, that's kind of what I wanted to say. So I tweeted something to that effect, a little light joke, ha, ha, ha. And Leah Hernandez, who tweets as the Diva Leah, who is doing an Indiegogo project right now called The Garlic, which is this comic about a family of vampires. It's very cute. You should check it out. She retweeted it. And then Kurt Busiek, a comic book writer I admire greatly, answered her and me indirectly by giving me the answer. So I could have done, you know, 2 minutes worth of Googling, or I could just wait for a guy who hears the answer. Because Marvel trademarked the term superhero as two words, DC trademarked it as a hyphenated word, and the rest of us use it as one word.
That is awesome.
Isn't that awesome?
That's totally awesome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So a question that...
Dinner parties, here I come.
That's been burning the American... Like, a question that
Social
man has sought an answer to for like...
making you happy this week.
Say 6 minutes, has finally been answered. So that was cool.
That is amazing. And it would be making me happy this week, too. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, one thing that makes me happy, speaking of Leah Hernandez, is her drawing, her original drawing of Chicktopus is framed so in such a manner that it is the last thing I see when I leave my house. It's right to the side of my front door, and it's just there to remind me that there's good in the world.
It's true.
The other thing that's making me happy is a few weeks old, and it's going to be old news to a lot of people, but I just finally sat down and listened to it, and it is Tig Notaro Live.
It's fantastic.
It's released on Louis C.K.'s website. It's $5.
You can pay through Amazon.
You can pay through
PayPal.
That.
You can
which
pay
is
through PayPal or Amazon.
Best $5 you will spend.
It is $5 just unbelievably well spent. For those who don't know, Tig Notaro is a comedian who specializes in this very dry, very everyday, kind of observational, just very understated, fun comic. She put out a really fun record called Good One a year or two ago. And she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And her mother died suddenly and tragically. And she suffered a horrible breakup. And
she had some sort of horrible digestive
there was another health issue
she'd been hospitalized for. And
basically, all of these things happened like
within a few months.
Right on top of each other. And so Louis C.K. is at this show, you know, to see her, and is talking to her before the set, and she sort of tells him, like, well, there's this, and there's this, and there's this, and there's this. And he tells this story on his website, and I highly recommend you read it if you haven't. And she basically goes out and does her set all about everything that's gone on in her life. And the audience reactions, not only is she incredibly funny and incredibly smart and handles it the incredibly right way, but it is just fascinating to hear how different members of the audience who are audible throughout mm-hmm. this recording. And her little comments on the sort of, aww, that some people in the audience have.
Yeah. And she keeps saying to them, one of the things that one of my friends commented on is how she keeps saying to them, you're okay. You're going to be okay.
Yeah.
You're okay. You're going to be, and I'm okay. I mean, I might not be okay. But it's going to be okay. And like she has, she and it becomes funny, and yet it's also incredibly warm. Like how is in this sort of exchange with them where they are so sad for her and they don't know whether it's okay to laugh. And she's not, she's not playing it purely for hysterical laughter the way that comedians sometimes do. Mm-hmm. She's playing it as a mix. She's doing sort of both a stand-up routine and what I would consider more of a monologue.
Right.
But it's a blend of those two things.
Just love it. Tig Notaro Live. Just go to louisck.com, $5.
We'll link to it. We'll link to it. It's wonderful. And also the two of them, I haven't even gotten to listen to it yet, but the two of them were on Fresh Air.
Yeah, she was on This American Life, too.
Yeah.
She's gotten a bunch in the last week.
Yeah. So, you know, it really is an example of sort of making lemonade out of lemons, as it were. That is a great pick.
Very Thompson. Funny lemonade.
Barry Hardiman, what's making you happy this week?
The League is back, which is not nearly of the quality of Tig Notaro in either, or the dignity either, I will say. And in fact, I want to actually point out again, too, that I am a card-carrying feminist, and this show is pure male fantasy. It makes me laugh so hard. These comedians are hilarious. It is a ridiculous show. I highly recommend it.
This is about fantasy football leagues?
It's about fantasy football. This is stuff I don't care about. Male fantasies, football, fantasy, football. I mean, nothing, none of this is stuff I care about at all. Everyone will vouch for me on this. And yet, I find it hilarious. It is truly ridiculous and silly. I highly recommend it. I was thrilled to see it pop up on my little DVR this week. So
that's wonderful.
Yes,
happy
it is
that
wonderful.
You have
but again, I'm very highly lacking in dignity. So please do not judge
What network is that?
FX.
Gotcha.
Speaking of lack of dignity.
I'm glad you have your show back.
Yeah,
Barry.
I do.
Let's see. I guess I will go with, I have a bunch of things, you know, that I've been watching and reading and checking out and stuff. And I talked about this on the blog today, but I have not talked about it on the show before. And it is a film called Beauty is Embarrassing, which is a documentary about an artist named Wayne White. And if you don't know who Wayne White is, which I did not before I saw this film, he did some of the puppets and production design on Pee Wee's Playhouse. Mm. He worked on The Weird Al Show. Mm-hmm. He worked on Beekman's World. Mm-hmm. He worked on a bunch of stuff like that. And he kind of, there's a whole aesthetic of kind of big head puppets and stuff like that, that he is a big part. He was a big part of sort of the development of this. And it was used a lot on kids shows, but not exclusively on kids shows. He also worked on the Peter Gabriel Big Time video.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So he did a lot of this really, really neat stuff. And now he's an artist, and he's mostly now known for these word paintings that he does, where he buys cheap old lithographs, like landscapes, cheap old landscape paintings, like at thrift shops, and paints words onto them. And so it'll just say something like, there's one that he did where I'm going to explain it even though I can't actually say it, but there's one where it's called F bleep U invasion. And all it is it's a seascape where all you see is like, they're like big ships, and it says F U. And big, huge letters, and the letters are built like ships, and they're all coming up to the beach, and it's called the FU invasion. And he loves to just make like blocks of words, and some of them they're not all swearing, although a lot of them are. There's one that says something like, in a series of signs, like Burma Shave signs, it says, just a painting scorned by scholars. Now it's worth $10,000. And it's like, he's so clever and funny. And he's got this really cool family. His wife is incredibly cool. She's a cartoonist who has, she wrote the first Simpsons ever, the Open Fire, the actual original Simpsons she wrote. But mostly she's a cartoonist. She works in Village Voice and stuff like that. And he's just an incredibly interesting guy. And he's constantly like walking around his house. He's just got all kinds of stuff. And it's in various states of like, well, I started on this, and this is a marionette made out of sticks. And he's just got all this stuff lying around. And he's just one of those explosively creative people that He just can't not make stuff all the time. And you know people like that, and they can be really annoying and manic, but he's actually really cool and interesting. And I loved this movie. I saw it at Silver Docks. It had also been at South by Southwest. I'd missed it. But it's available on demand. It's on iTunes. It's on Amazon on demand. It's also on a lot of cable systems. But it might be buried. Like, you might have to dig around in
What's
your cable
again?
System. It's called Beauty is Embarrassing. And I highly, highly recommend it. I think it's absolutely wonderful. And I really encourage people to seek it out and watch it. If you've liked sort of any of the offbeat documentary stuff that we've sometimes talked about on the show, this is another one, I would say. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Barry at B Hardiman, that's H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. You can follow our esteemed producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. And you can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In Still, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.